Welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off of the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies list. As my voice has abandoned me, leaving my body a joyless prison, this my only recourse to chat with all of you about the films we love. With me as always, Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm honestly more scared of this than any film we've watched.
Ha ha ha, that is so true. So true. Sigh.
Hello. My voice has come back just a little bit.
Wow, just in time.
Only because it would have taken too long.
Oh my God.
To type and play that as we were going through. Yes, this is the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay. With me as always is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
Better now.
Good.
Better now that you're back with what little voice you have.
It's getting a little better.
Yeah. It sounds like it hurts you less to talk.
It hurts me less, but there's like a wall, you know, where it's like I feel like there's a smaller hole for the voice to go through in the vocal cord.
This is very specific.
I assume that's how it works.
I have no idea.
I have read no books.
Google will tell you.
But yeah, that's neither here nor there. Today, we are talking about The Devil's Backbone from 2001. Yes. Number 56 on our list with a 93% Rotten Tomatoes score and an 89% audience score. Amanda, had you seen this before?
I had not. I knew it was a Guillermo del Toro movie. I have been interested in seeing it for a long time.
Yeah.
I will admit that it wasn't until recently that I did more than just look at the title and go, cool. So it was very different than I was expecting based off of the name of the movie.
Yep.
But I really liked it.
Yeah. I feel like this is one of those ones that only since it was put in the Criterion Collection, does it have a presentation that is at all, like a physical media presentation that is, pleasant to look at.
Yeah.
Cause generally it's like a weird smushy ghost picture and like some...
Like that weird, like kind of scribbled or like carved and like kids carving letters into a wall kind of style font.
Yeah, not quite. Huh. You wouldn't steal a car, would you? Not that font, not the screen font, but similar.
Right, right.
Similar to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched this in college. I've only seen it once. Mm-hmm. So, I think I remember watching this my freshman year of college. So it must have been shortly after it came out. I'm trying to figure out why I watched this.
Huh.
Because if it was in college, it would have been 2002, maybe 2003. Maybe Blade 2 had come out by that point, and I was interested in this new Del Toro fellow.
Yeah. I mean, when Pan's Labyrinth came out, too, that was a big...
Yeah.
I feel like that made a big splash.
Yep.
And what was that, like 06?
Yeah, I think I was out of college by that point. I can't remember. I don't remember when. Anyway.
Yeah.
I watched this and I was kind of underwhelmed by it. I don't know. I don't know if I was fully ready for this kind of movie.
Sure.
Especially if I was in fact coming off of Blade 2.
Yeah. yeah, very different vibes.
To this other film by this Guillermo del Toro guy. Mm-hmm. Not quite what I expected. He's one of those guys where I'm really up and down on him.
Really?
And there was a period probably around this point in my life where I think I was a lot more not anti-
Skeptical,
I guess would be the word. Like, I didn't love Pan's Labyrinth when it came out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And everybody loved Pan's Labyrinth.
I did. That movie devastated me when I watched it.
Yeah, I think that's another one that I want to revisit because I think I would like it more now than I did at the time. My biggest beef with Pan's Labyrinth was there wasn't enough labyrinth. Like, I remember, like, all the stuff, fair. The fantasy stuff was really cool.
It's a metaphorical labyrinth,
I know, but, like, I was expecting more fantasy stuff from him. But anyway.
Metaphor.
He is a director who I maintain, if he can get a good script,
mm-hmm.
he can make a great movie.
Mm.
But he very rarely gets a good script.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes.
I think we're going to play the trailer and just jump right into it. But before we do that, if you'd like to help support the show and follow us as we tackle a plethora, or I should say a dozen of horror movie sequels this year on Patreon, you can go over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile and follow us over there. January was Gremlins 2.
Mm-hmm.
February was... Dracula Has Risen from the Grave.
Yes.
And I had incorrectly stated that March was going to be Final Destination 2. It is actually going to be Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Yes.
Because Amanda and I will be going to see the 40th anniversary screening of it.
In a theater.
At the Boston Underground Film Festival later this month. So we are going to make sure I can write it off on my taxes by... covering it on our show.
And make everybody wait for Final Destination 2, which I know will be painful for everyone involved.
Is that one person who's like, no!
Yeah. And cancel patron membership.
But until then, we're going to take a quick break, play the trailer for Devil's Backbone, and come back and talk about it. Okay, The Devil's Backbone, directed by Guillermo del Toro, written by, I just realized that I wrote over the people who wrote the book.
Hey.
Written by Guillermo del Toro, Antonio Trashoras, and David Munoz. Starring Marissa Paredes, Eduardo Noriega, Federico Lupi, Fernando Tielve, Iñigo Garces, Irene Vicedo, Jose Manuel Lorenzo, Francisco Maestre, and Junio Valverde. Amanda.
Yes, Clay.
What happens in The Devil's Backbone?
After Carlos, a 12-year-old whose father has died in the Spanish Civil War, arrives at an ominous boys' orphanage, he discovers the school is haunted and has many dark secrets which he must uncover.
Sure.
Yeah. Serviceable.
More or less.
Well, Clay, some things you'll find in The Devil's Backbone include Spanish Christopher Lee.
It was the first thing I thought when I saw that guy. He looks a lot like Christopher Lee.
Yeah, I see it.
And this is like Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Very similar hair.
Beard.
Very similar, short white beard.
Yeah.
I guess this is also Lord of the Rings era Christopher. Anyway, he looks like Christopher Lee.
Yes, sure.
I feel like that's on purpose.
I don't think it's on purpose. I think that man just looks that way.
Knowing Guillermo del Toro, I feel like it's on purpose.
All right, maybe. Questionable tutoring.
I don't actually know him like personally. I didn't want to.
You did refer to him earlier as that he's one of those guys, which is like... very casual way to refer to a very famous director.
Yeah.
Yes.
What'd you say?
Questionable tutoring.
Questionable tutoring.
Yes.
Generally, you don't want your tutor to drop you, abandon you at an orphanage, and then go get executed by the Spanish government.
Well, not really the Spanish government yet.
Was it the...
It's Franco.
Franco's
fascist forces.
Dave or James?
Both. They used to be one person. Did you know that?
Yeah, they were a horrible human being, apparently.
An unfulfilled Chekhov's bomb.
Yeah. Is that first time in movie history?
Yeah.
I had a memory.
Speaking of the metaphors, the bomb is a metaphor, Clay.
Oh. Even is the unexploding a metaphor?
I don't know.
I had a memory that the bomb did go off.
Oh.
But I realized as we were watching the movie, what I was actually remembering was Rambo 4, which also has an unexploded ordnance subplot. But that movie has the balls to blow the bomb up at the end of it.
I see.
And make a statement about Burma.
Sorry, this movie didn't make a statement about Burma.
I'm just saying they're both political films. One of which involves an insane level of homicide and murderous war. And the other one is Rambo 4.
Yeah. You'll also find a man called Pig and a boy called Owl.
It's too bad they never met. I bet they could have avoided some of the
bad
things.
They
kind
of met.
If they bombed.
Pig was there when they threw all the boys, including Owl, into the... They locked them in the little storage room.
They didn't have a chance to bond over their names, though.
That's true.
Oh, well.
I don't know. The buddy movie you'll never see.
Yeah. They're all dead now.
Inexplicable slug collecting.
It didn't look like there was a lot to do there.
But
so.
What do you do? You take them and you put them in your shoebox, and then what do you do with them?
You'd show them to people.
Boys are
what
weird.
What do you do with any of the stuff in that box?
Boys are weird. Agua de Limbo, a.k.a. fetus water.
Yeah, that was pretty gross.
Yeah, it's real gross.
The fun part about that, I don't know if that's a real thing. I'm going to say probably not.
I hope not.
The name of this movie actually comes from a mountain range in Mexico, which originally when Del Toro wrote it, it was going to be take place in Mexico because he is Mexican.
Yes, that makes sense.
But after... His second movie, which was Mimic, which he made with Miramax.
Yeah.
It was a horrible experience. And he happened to run into Pedro Almodovar at a film festival. And he was like, I want to produce your next movie. And so that's why he produced this. And since they were making it in Spain, he just... And both of those places have civil type wars to mine from in their history.
Yes.
He changed the setting to the Spanish Civil War, or not Spanish Civil War. Is that what it is? Spanish Civil War?
Yeah.
Okay. And then adjusted the name to keep the title into this bottle of
weird rum from a fetus.
Yeah. Spina bifida fetus rum.
It's so gross.
I got to say, cooler than this ridge of mountains known as the Devil's Backbone.
Debatable. You'll also find a marble made from 6 months of mud and snot.
Yeah. That would be the worst How Things Get Made YouTube video, I think. Just a time lapse of hawking up loogies and mixing it with mud.
Oh, God.
And refining it. Refining it down.
Well, along with that, you'll also find a photorealistic drawing of a woman.
Perfectly rendered.
Yeah, her chichi is exactly how a real one is.
Yeah. I love how casual he's like, no, this is a really well-drawn picture of woman.
I mean, it essentially looks like reality. Yeah.
I don't know.
I like that they're all the boys are like, wow, who did this? Peeping Tomas.
Peeping Tomas.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got for that.
That's all you just really wanted.
I just
that
wanted
one.
That one in there.
A fake leg full of gold.
Great place to hide it. I feel like it's gonna throw you off.
Balance-wise. Yeah. I mean, she does have the cane, though.
That's true. So. Unless it actually evens you out, because if it's a hollow leg, now you have, like, the gold. If the gold is the same weight as your calf
muscle. But now I'm thinking about it, and she was complaining about how much her leg hurt right before they get blown up.
That's true.
So it must have been the extra weight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. And last but certainly not least, Santi el Fantasma Amistoso.
Santi. The friendly ghost.
Yep. Poor chico. Actually
played by two actors.
Really?
Because one of them had a...
One of them was alive, one of them was dead?
Yeah, it was a puppet.
Oh, no. I meant one was an actual ghost. I didn't.
One of them doing the water stuff had like a medical thing where like the pressure was too much for his on his eardrums.
Small boy ears.
Yeah. And so they had to switch in, grab another boy from the orphanage and throw him in the lake, or the pit.
In the cistern. Yeah.
Okay. Devil's Backbone.
So what do you know about the Spanish Civil War, Clay?
Where do you want me to start?
Time for a history lesson. Go.
Once there was a Spain. Uh-huh. And once then when both sides of that Spain got mad at each other.
Uh-huh.
Over, I mean, I don't want to go into it. It's too many things.
Okay.
There was a civil war.
Uh-huh.
Yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
Franco.
Uh-huh. James and or?
Fascism.
Okay.
And he's dead now.
Cool.
Still dead, as Chevy Chase would say. Yeah, I had actually, so obviously Frankenstein has come out this year.
Mm-hmm.
Was that technically this year? I guess it was this year.
In the last 12-month span, yeah.
And so anytime, you know, I always tend on going a bit of a rabbit hole when these big directors have their new movies come out. And I had just recently watched Crimson Peak, which I had never seen before. Have you seen Crimson Peak?
No, I haven't seen that one.
I remember it being not very well received at the time.
Yeah, I feel like people did not like it.
Yeah, but I actually really enjoyed it because it has like all the things I like. It's like a gothic ghost story, romance.
I think that's part of the problem is like people think horror movie and they don't think gothic horror movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of a cognitive dissonance sometimes when they go into these of like the gothic horror movie genre has a lot in common with like gothic romance novels. Yeah.
Speaking of, I have not seen or read Wuthering Heights.
I really want to see it.
I do too. However,
uh-huh.
I was under the impression from the song and other casual osmosis I've gotten from the story that there is a ghost involved.
And
apparently there is no ghost in the movie.
No, but...
So now I'm at a crossroads.
Clay, it's a metaphor.
Does my displeasure with the fact that there is no ghost in the movie outweigh the fact that I would watch Margot Robbie do literally anything?
I don't think it outweighs it.
No?
Because it's not the movie's fault.
It is. They didn't put the ghost in.
But there's not really a ghost in the book either.
Well, it sounds like there could have been.
It's sort
so
of.
I am unhappy with their creative choice. Okay. Which is how criticism works now in the 21st century.
Someone didn't make this specifically for me.
They didn't do what I wanted them to do.
It shouldn't exist.
Correct.
Yes. It has been a long time since I've read that book. But there's definitely a scene or two where things get ghostly.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Where it's sort of like, Is this person imagining things? Is it kind of in their mind that they are being haunted by the memories of this other character? So there's, again, it's a metaphor.
Well, let me bring it back around.
Yes.
To say that one of the things I appreciate about Guillermo del Toro, first of all, he seems to really like ghost stories.
Yes.
I would say that even though this is a Spanish Civil War movie, I think it is very at home in the gothic tradition.
Oh, yeah.
However, I appreciate that he also likes the ghosts. And it's not a metaphor. I mean, maybe it's a metaphor, but it's it's also a ghost.
Right, right. It's both. It's a metaphor, but it is a literal ghost in this world.
Yeah, it's not just someone who is mad because they have to do too many chores and now they've gone insane.
Right, right. Or someone broke up with them 20 years ago.
Right.
And now they're haunted by it.
Or they just can't stand the wallpaper in their bedroom.
That story is actually kind of terrifying.
It is. It's really good.
I always appreciate a movie where it just goes all in on the supernatural aspect of it.
Yeah.
Like, there's some movies where leaving it up to the audience interpretation of, is there a real ghost here? Or is this person losing their mind? That can work when it's done well. I think that can definitely work. But I really like a movie that's like, this is a ghost story. Here's the ghost.
Yeah.
Like, there is a ghost. Like, I remember watching The Innkeepers.
Yep.
and being a little bit like, because that movie is very, very slow, very mm-hmm. slow paced. And you go through a long period of like, is there actually any ghost here? Is this really happening? And eventually that movie also comes back around to like, no, yeah, there's at least one.
Sure
not
does.
Two ghosts. Yeah. But it does leave you in limbo, no pun intended, for a little while of like, is she just freaking herself out or
right,
is there a
right.
ghost? I appreciate that this one gets pretty quick to like, hey, did you see the little ghost boy standing in the doorway?
Yes. And what I also like about the way he handles ghosts is he still maintains that sort of gothic tradition where even though there is a ghost present
mm-hmm.
and influencing parts of the story, mm-hmm. It is the actions of the humans in the story
yes.
that cause the real horror.
Yes.
Generally, it tends to also include, as it does in this movie, the mm-hmm. creation of said ghost.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've noticed that in the movies that he does like this, the bad guys
mm-hmm.
are the worst people you've ever encountered in your
yes,
life.
Yes, they're very clearly the bad guys.
I remember very clearly from Pan's Labyrinth
yeah.
that the father or the stepfather is just like a horrible, horrible human.
Yeah, yeah. Like there is no question about who the main antagonist is in these movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he also has no fear as in terms of putting children in danger.
Oh yeah, he blows up a bunch of kids in this movie.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And infamously the end of Pan's Labyrinth.
Does that happen in Pan's Labyrinth too?
I don't know if he blows up a bunch of kids, but he kills them.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay, it's been a while.
Yeah.
He calls that a sister film to this one. Mm. They are very similar.
Yes. Yeah, you can see a lot of thematic overlap between the two. And I think I read somewhere that the two main character boys, Carlos and I'm going to say Jamie.
Yep.
Carlos and Jamie.
Jaime.
I think they end up playing... like socialist insurgents.
Do they really?
In That's Pan's fun. Labyrinth. So there's sort of a, how connected are these movies? Is this just a few years later when the boys have become, you know, guerrilla warfare
right.
soldiers themselves?
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. I do want to say, like, speaking about Guillermo del Toro, there were a couple things I recently read about him that I thought was really funny and kind of great. One of them that I'm thinking about right now was he was offered the opportunity to do the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie.
Oh, really?
And he turned it down. And his stated reason for turning it down was he had no interest in resurrecting the lion. So he
want to talk about metaphors.
Right. He wanted to kill the lion and leave it dead.
Sure.
And that's kind of sums him up, though. Like,
yeah,
he's a lot of his movies are not afraid of killing major characters, and he doesn't go for the like, he never does like the fake out, you know what I mean, when it comes
right.
to like if a character dies in his films, they're gone or they've become a sad and vengeful ghost.
Yeah.
But I think he has a certain commitment to like, there are not fully happy endings.
Yeah.
Like loss is a part of life and is a part of stories, and loss is permanent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, because he, from all, everything that I've briefly looked up,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't seem like he had a particularly horrible childhood or anything.
No, I think he actually had a shockingly good one, because his dad like won the lottery and they became millionaires.
Yeah. Which allowed him yeah. to do a lot of the film yeah. stuff that he did.
Did you, not to get too far into like the biographical information, but did you see the thing about the fact that his father was kidnapped?
I remember that, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I believe they got him back.
They did.
Yeah.
They did, but it was like I think it was like 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, that was not
him.
That long ago. It was like maybe...
late 90s?
I thought it was more recent. I thought it was like 10 years ago.
I think it was...
Well, anyway.
Further back.
He's fine.
Yeah, yeah. His dad's fine. He's fine. But that's why they left Mexico.
Oh, I didn't know yeah. that. But yeah, I for someone who he makes the kind of, he goes back and forth
mm-hmm.
between the movies of a person who grew up reading monster books
yes.
and comic books and watching monster movies.
Yeah.
And the kind of movies someone who lived through the Mexican or Spanish Civil
yes.
War would make.
Yeah, with this sort of like long tradition of magical realism interwoven into like horror and real human tragedy.
Yeah. Which I really like, because I feel like he seems to use these movies as a way to, I'm going to assume he's kind of processing this history that he's been aware of. Because I mean, when I did my book Bloody Hell, I took in so much stuff before I did the book. It's always funny when you do that, because then you sit down to write and you realize like half the crap you took in you don't even use. But what you do use, or at least what I used, is I had taken in so much stuff about World War One that the book that I ended up making was just me trying to like wrap my mind around it.
Yeah.
And make any kind of sense of it as I could.
Yeah.
Because it was such a horrible, nightmarish chapter of human history.
Yeah.
That it's like it was the only way I could like process the stuff that I took in. And I feel like he's kind of doing the same thing. Either that or he just likes it as the background. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming, again, you know, we're kind of making some leaps here, but
sure.
Given that this, you said this was originally supposed to take place during like the Mexican Revolution, like Civil War there. And then he shifted the setting, and I'm guessing, you know, he could see a lot of commonalities between what these two countries went through.
Sure.
And I think setting it in the Spanish Civil War is really interesting, because I don't know about you, but that is something I, other than learning the name like Francisco Franco, like it was like, that was it. And I don't know anything. I didn't really learn anything else about it, like in school. You know, it was just sort of this, okay, yeah, and that happened. And then hurry up, World War II.
Right, yeah.
But it really is kind of this trigger point in Europe of the rise in fascism.
Right, yeah.
Where you've got Germany and Italy and now Spain. And it's like kind of this initial conflict that showed how far things were going to go.
Yeah.
And how bad it foreshadowed how bad things were going to get.
Yeah.
And I think initially a lot of people and other European countries kind of tried to pretend it wasn't happening.
What's that like?
I don't know. But even in the movie, there's like a throwaway line where I forget if it's Carmen or the doctor, where they say like, well, you don't know, England or France could still come and help us. And it's like, spoiler alert, they do not.
Right, yeah. Like,
so I think it's a really interesting choice to put to set this movie in that kind of like pivotal moment of right before this horrible tipping point is going to happen.
Do you think it uses that setting enough? Because it really does kind of just use it as a setting. Like, it doesn't touch it that much.
It touches it
in that it exists as sort of like this overbearing stressor, because, you know, the gold in the vault is for the rebels.
Yep.
And obviously the Carlos gets abandoned because his tutor is part of the resistance. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the desperation seems to be the desperation of the people seems to be kind of echoed in the desperation of the orphanage, because they say they're in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
You know, the only things that they have are the only things that they have. Yep. No one's coming to save them, like you said.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I'm kind of working through my own answer as I talk now. But I was thinking about it earlier, and I was thinking, well, I mean, they only kind of have that one scene where the tutor and the other guys get executed. That's like a real brush up with the war.
Sure.
But I think, I'm sorry, I'm answering the question I asked.
No, that's okay. I can answer after you.
I think one of the things that he does well when he deals with this stuff is he does tell these stories that happen in the margins, because you've got the centerpiece of the orphanage is this bomb that didn't go off.
Yes.
That could have killed everybody.
Yes.
And you've got these external factors that are pressing on the story, but not mm-hmm. necessarily the focal point. Because yeah. I also think, did you see his Pinocchio?
No, I couldn't. I don't know. It weirded me out.
I watched the first like maybe half an hour. It's very good.
Yeah.
But it also takes place during the Spanish Civil War.
Oh,
or possibly Mexican. I can't remember which one.
Okay.
And involves the reason Geppetto makes Pinocchio is because while his son was praying at church, the church got bombed.
Oh, damn.
So he definitely
that is a dark Pinocchio.
He definitely has this soup of revolution mixed with cultural and military revolution mixed with a big heaping of Catholicism.
Oh yeah,
that permeates all of these movies he does that are these ones that kind of are smaller and more personal stories.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's definitely a result of being like a person from Mexico or Central or South America.
Yeah.
Who has absolutely been raised in that soup, as you put it, of both cultural and military revolution and Catholicism.
Yeah.
Like those are huge social influences very much still to this day. In those countries, and especially like outside of the capitals, you know what I mean? Like, like if you're in like the big city, you might notice it a little bit less, but like,
oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But even so, like there are a lot of museums and things in like Mexico and South America where it is like, this is the Museum of Remembrance where we talk about all the people that the regime disappeared.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. And it's like very much a still extremely present part of history in a lot of countries that have gone through these kinds of very violent, very bloody revolutions.
Yeah.
Where there are still like living members of families who just say, yep, one day, like my son and my daughter went off and I never saw them again.
Yeah.
And there's things like that.
But I mean, the Mexican Revolution was just over 100 years ago. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. As when it comes to this movie and like the war as part of the setting, I think he does what you were saying where it is on the margins and you could probably superimpose a couple different civil wars onto this movie. But I think the reason why setting it in the Spanish Civil War works so well is you have that right balance of like period piece and modernity.
Sure.
Like it's right at that tipping point into what we have now considered more the modern era, like the post-World War II era. Like you're riding right up to the line of that where people are still, you know, Jacinto, the main antagonist there, is still in his like wide leg trousers and suspenders looking like a tough guy.
Yeah.
But you also have like war planes. You have bombs falling from the sky.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of still a relatively new and horrifying thing that is happening to people at the time of like, World War I was not that long ago, and now all of a sudden you're in this era of mechanized warfare.
Yeah.
And also World War I have to deal with that.
Didn't really touch Spain.
Right.
Proper anyway.
Yes. Yeah. And so you have it creates this pressure cooker around the orphanage.
Yeah.
Where everybody is desperate and everyone is on their own. And the systems of authority that used to be there to keep things in line are gone because there's so much conflict and there's so much turmoil and people are getting killed and people are running away and people are just disappearing. And so it means that this vulnerable group of kids being taken care of by a couple of old people and like one young teacher are even more vulnerable than they otherwise would be.
Yeah.
And they're in the middle of nowhere and no one has time to pay attention to them. And I like that because of the economic situation, I think early in the movie, Carmen says when they're dropping off Carlos and they're saying you have to keep him. And she says, we can't take another boy. We don't have the food. Like all the boys that are already here are hungry. We don't have enough food for another boy.
Yeah.
I couldn't even use your gold to buy food if I wanted to. It's essentially worthless to us because there just is no food. Even if people wanted to sell them food, there is none.
Yeah.
And so I think it creates this like the way the bomb in the middle of the courtyard is a metaphor, the war on the outside is the other metaphor, sure, of like, yeah, no matter how you look at it, this situation is unsustainable and something is going to blow.
Yeah.
And I like that. I think that works really well.
Yeah. 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 And I think you see it, except for the doctor. The doctor seems to be enjoying himself.
Yeah.
He seems to.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact that he's, how would I describe his relationship with the headmistress? Can you be a cuckold if you're not actually in a relationship with somebody?
I don't think so.
No.
But he comes real close.
Yeah. Aside from that, he's having a great time.
Yeah.
But Jacinto, he's in a really weird position because, mm-hmm, like, he's a horrible guy.
Yep.
But it's pretty explicitly stated that, you know, he was abused as a child, mm-hmm, and he's been stuck here in, mm-hmm, this, you know, for lack of a better term, limbo.
Yeah.
For his whole life.
Yeah.
And they also, does he say that he's basically been sleeping with the headmistress since he was like a child?
17.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. I do want to talk about him.
Did you see that another teacher just got like arrested for sleeping with a 16-year-old student? God,
I don't.
Female teacher.
Look, I went to a high school where this happened. I don't.
Listen, all I hear is that girls want to date older guys because they're more mature. Why are these girls messing around with these young kids?
I think what you mean to say is, why are these women abusing these children?
Yes.
Look.
You have to answer for
equality,
your entire gender.
Right? Men can abuse children on an international level.
That's true.
And women will do it at this one school. I think Jacinto is such an interesting character because he kind of mirrors Santi, the ghost, a little bit in the way he's presented, where like there's a lot of fear and dread built up, and they both come across as antagonists. But there are these moments that Del Toro weaves in where you feel some sympathy for them.
Yeah.
And whereas Santi is obviously the much more innocent victim in this, like, he is a scary ghost, and then very much you see him as a victim, and then he kind of becomes a scary ghost again at the end when he fucking kills that guy.
Yeah.
But Jacinto is interesting because he's such a, like, overt antagonist, like you were saying, like, in these movies, it's so obvious who the bad guy is. It's like, oh yeah, it's the one who's, like, abusing the boys,
right,
and
yeah,
trying to steal the gold from the orphanage. But you do get these brief flashes into him of the fact that, like, he was orphaned himself and was raised in this orphanage and clearly has a lot of unresolved issues around that.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of ways he himself is mentally still a boy.
Yep.
Like, mentally still more around Jamie's age than an actual, like, mature adult. And I think his relationship with Carmen, in addition to being really problematic, is also really complicated because the actor who plays him does such a great job, I think.
Yeah.
Because there are moments where he is kind of upset that she doesn't love him more.
Yeah.
You know, like, he gets kind of like, there's that, how did I put it? Deeply uncomfortable sex scene.
Oh, yes.
Between them. And when she kind of tells him to be quiet, he says to her, oh, you're embarrassed. You don't want Casare to, like, the doctor to hear us. And she's like, oh, no, I'm ashamed.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're ashamed of me. And she's kind of like, yeah. You know, like, I'm ashamed of myself, but yeah, also you. And he's hurt. And the confrontation he has with her before they try to kick him out of the orphanage fully, like, he is hurt by her,
yeah,
like, emotionally. And it's clear that there's, I think because she abused him when he was so young, he's got his wires crossed, right? Like,
yeah,
this is the closest thing to a mother he's ever had, but he's sleeping with her.
Right.
And has been for, I don't know how old he's supposed to be, but probably several years at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's interesting. And you get that like kind of weirdly tender moment where part of the material in the safe, once they finally bust it open, are pictures of him as a child.
Right. Yeah.
And he's sitting by the fire with his like cronies and he's kind of reminiscing like, look at my dad. My dad was so cool. And they're sort of like, all right, weirdo. But he has this weirdly like tender moment reminiscing about his own childhood.
And then he reads the message on the back of that picture. Yes. That's essentially like, poor Jacinto. Yeah. So sorry, your life is going to suck.
A prince with no kingdom and a man without warmth, I think is what she writes on the back.
Yeah. Great. Thanks,
yeah.
Mom.
Yeah. But I think it's Carmen. I think Carmen writes it.
Oh, does Carmen write it?
Because she says something like that to him before he blows everybody up and she dies.
Right.
But it's so interesting because he is very much the villain, but he has these weird moments of like self-doubt and insecurity and vulnerability that make him read as like he goes from very scary to almost childlike himself. Like Even when he accidentally kills Santi, it is an accident.
Yeah.
He shoves him, Santi hits his head, and then you see him kind of panic and like he's like visibly shaken and upset. It wasn't like he set out to kill this kid.
Yeah. And clearly the only thing he knows, the only way he knows how to deal with things is through violence.
Yes. Yes.
I'm assuming there was probably someone there who was smacking him around.
Right.
You know, I don't think the doctor was doing it.
No,
but
probably
wasn't doing
other
it.
Other boys probably.
Yeah.
Right.
Or if there was an older man who was there at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like sort of, the little monologue that the doctor does where he says, what is a ghost? Is it something that just repeats over and over again? And It's kind of like that's built into this movie is the like cyclical nature of like somebody abuses someone and that person goes on to abuse someone and like, things just spiral out of control.
I do have to say I'm really glad that they don't spell that out.
Same.
Because I feel like if Mike Flanagan made this movie, there'd be a 20-minute sequence where we see how abused Jacinto was as a child.
Yeah, I was gonna compare.
As much as I love Mike Flanagan,
I do too. And I was actually gonna compare the two of them, and say they're directors who are kind of cut from the same cloth in a lot of ways, and I think they have a lot of similar preoccupations, and I think they both come at things from this place of like emotion.
Sure.
Like there's an emotional connection and there's always some sort of sympathy even for the seemingly bad characters or like the monsters and the ghosts.
Yeah.
There's some level of melancholy built into it. But yeah, I think Mike Flanagan would have had a whole like back and forth between two characters about certain things that this movie just sort of like moves on because it's from a kid's point of view and it's like kids don't do that.
I also think that Del Toro is a bit more, I don't know if cynical is the right word, because Flanagan stuff tends to end on an upswing.
Sure.
And a lot of times it's like the ghost all along was love, you know?
Yeah. Or the ghosts will go away once we accept that we've been grieving our father or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, once you learn how to hug your dad, then the ghost goes away. But Del Toro, I think in line with what you're saying about how when, you know, people die, they're dead in his movies. Mm. I think that level of terror and trauma, he never really gives you a lot of catharsis for it. Mm. Because, you know, what's the girl's name? Not Carmen, the other one.
Conchita?
Conchita.
Yeah. Poor Conchita.
Yeah, Conchita. Her, I feel like in a different movie, the ghost of Conchita might have helped the kids at some point or something.
Yeah.
But she just gets killed.
Right.
The doctor presents himself as this guy who's going to watch over the kids and he just fucking dies.
Yep.
And it's not glamorous.
No.
And he's covered in flies and stuff. And he does reappear in ghost form.
Yeah.
But as he says at the end of the movie, it's like, I'm stuck here. This sucks.
Right. Right. And all he's able to do when he reappears in ghost form is unlock the door for them.
Oh, worst ghost power.
I mean, it's in the moment, it's the ghost power they needed.
That's true.
So,
I guess if it's better than not being able to do anything.
Exactly. But it still means that he could help them a little bit.
Yeah.
when they really needed it, but then they're still on their own.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, even Santi gets, I guess revenge is the right word to use.
Yeah.
But even there, it's like,
well, there's no white light for Santi.
Right.
You
it's
know?
Not like he goes to heaven.
Right. It's not like his dead parents come down from the sky and are like, our son, we can finally be together. He's just like left floating above the water in the cistern at the very end, kind of. Yep. Also stuck here.
Yeah. Which I think is a, I think that approach, I prefer that approach because I like it when ghost stories like this don't fully resolve.
Yeah.
And there is still ghostliness to be had.
Yes.
Because I you know, the stuff that if you're talking about ghosts as something that is just replaying, et cetera, that's not going to go away.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that's just, that energy is still going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is like real life more in a weird way. I know it probably sounds weird to say that, but like, sometimes bad shit just happens.
Yeah.
And you deal with it as best you can. But sometimes bad shit just happens and there is no lesson to be learned from it. There's no kind of coming out the other side stronger or receiving some sort of closure. It's like, yeah, sometimes something awful happens and then it just has to, it just hangs there. It doesn't resolve.
Yeah. I wonder if I've filled my life with too much narrative because that still bothers me in real life.
Really?
Because like so often it feels like this isn't how the way things should go.
Interesting.
You know, like if you were trying to map this out as a story, this isn't how you would end the story.
Mm.
But that's usually how it ends.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating.
Yes, that's true.
What do you think of the kids?
I think the kids are great.
Yeah, they're really good.
I think this movie benefits from letting the kids mostly just act with the other kids.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like the child actors are mostly amongst themselves for big swaths of this movie. And like when an adult comes in, it is an authority figure who is a little bit at a distance. Because like none of these kids have parents. So you're never looking at it and being like, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a believable parent-child relationship. It's like, no, most of these kids lost their families really tragically and then just kind of got dumped here.
Yeah.
And now they just have to adapt to this very different little isolated kind of society and, you know, roll with it.
Yeah.
And I think the dynamics between the different kids are really fun.
Yeah. I really appreciate that the that Carlos doesn't become like, for lack of a better term, like a super kid.
Mm.
That he's there as the entryway to the story.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not like the key to solving anything, or I don't mean that like in a Joseph Campbell type sense. I just mean like, you know, he just becomes part of the story.
Yeah.
Like, like the action doesn't hinge on, it hinges on Jaime more than it hinges on him.
Yeah. I mean, I do think he becomes, he doesn't become a super kid, but I do think the role he plays is special.
Yeah.
In that he comes into this little gang as an outsider and is able to sort of see things a little different than the other boys, which I think is why he's less afraid of going to Santi and like confronting the ghost.
That's true. Yeah.
But I see what you're saying though, where I like that it doesn't become like one boy's journey alone.
Like, yeah. Or just like, I like that he's not the sole point of view character.
Yeah,
I guess. It doesn't end at his point of view.
Right.
Or like, it's not like, man, when I was a kid, some crazy shit happened to me.
Right.
Not that they would do that, but
no.
I'm hyperbolizing.
Yeah. And the fact that in a lot of ways, this is actually Jamie's story.
Yeah.
Because he is the one who was friends with Santi and was there and watched him get killed, and he is the one who has, he's kind of the bomb waiting to go off.
Yeah.
You know, not to keep belaboring the metaphor, but, you know, he's just been sort of sitting and trapped here and kind of seems like he was going bitter and following in Jacinto's footsteps a little bit, as much as he hated him.
Yeah.
It was, again, going to be that cycle of like, this person did horrible things to you and ruined your life and you're powerless to stop them. And so you're just going to like perpetrate that back down on someone weaker than you. And Carlos coming in breaks that.
Yeah.
Because Jamie kind of starts doing that to Carlos and then Carlos wins him over.
Right. Yeah.
And they end up teaming up.
Yeah.
And I like doing it that way rather than it being like, oh no, Jamie's just like a flat bully. Like that's his whole character. And we're just going to have to like, he's going to be the secondary antagonist we have to get out of the way before we have like the big final confrontation.
Yeah. Or, I mean, there's other things I could have done with him where he's, yeah, he's standoffish for the whole movie until he has his turn at the end or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's nice that the kids kind of fold in with each other.
Yeah,
I do have to say though, and I'm always amazed at kids in movies when they're put in a situation where, you know, they're getting beat up or something, mm-hmm. and then the teacher's like, "Who did this?" And then the one kid just doesn't say anything, mm-hmm. and that always wins the other ones over.
Yeah.
If that was me at that age, I would have ratted on all those kids. It's like, those ones, those motherfuckers did this. Punish them.
I think it's different, though, when there's, like, the teacher-to-student ratio is smaller, and, like, you go home at the end of the day to your loving family.
Yeah. There's also a survival element.
Yes.
That I never had as a,
yes.
a 6-foot third grader
yeah.
in suburban Massachusetts.
That's true. I'm guessing not a lot of the other kids were fucking with you at that point.
So, no, you know, one or two, but I think anytime it happened,
mm-hmm.
I never really took it seriously because it always kind of felt like,
like a chihuahua attacking
kinda,
a pit bull.
Kinda, yeah. Yeah, there was some later on that really that bugged me, but early on when this stuff like really hits,
mm-hmm.
didn't really bother me that much.
If only we were all 6 foot tall sixth graders.
Then I'd have no power.
Yeah, then we'd all be equal.
Yeah, I think the kids are great.
Yeah.
One of the things that I do really like about the character, first of all, I really like the turn with the story of Jaime and Santi.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that they were legitimately friends.
Yes.
But they play it the whole movie as though like, yeah, he might have killed him.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Because he's kind of a dickhead.
Yep.
And you know, you don't know what's
going
on.
And you see that brief glimpse of that scene at the beginning of the movie where it is just Jamie kneeling down and Santi's on the ground bleeding already. And Jamie kneels down and kind of tries to like cradle his head and then ends up covered in blood. And he looks upset, but you're also kind of like, well, you know,
yeah.
Getting this one quick glimpse is like, okay, did he have something to do with it? What's going on?
It's easy to believe exactly what happened with him and Jacinto could have happened with him and Jaime.
Yeah.
But I do really like that with one notable exception, the adult characters all have pretty major flaws.
Yes.
And even the ones who are meant to be what's the word I'm looking for? Good guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
For lack of a better term.
Yeah. The trusted adults.
Yeah, the trusted adults. They're all presented as still as humans with flaws.
Yep.
Like you've got Carmen who clearly has her flaws regarding Jacinto.
Mm-hmm.
Jacinto clearly has a lot of things wrong with him.
Yes.
The doctor, he's generally the most benign, but even there, he's letting himself get walked all over by not only Carmen, but also Jacinto.
Yeah, there's a whole little dig in that character about impotence.
Right.
There's a lot of kind of talk of
he does bring it up a few times.
And other people bring it up too. Like Jacinto, when he's talking to Carmen, says, well, you had your husband and now you have the old man and, you know, neither one of them can do it for you because he might be a gentleman, but what you need is a hard cock.
Yeah.
Then he has the fetus water and he's selling it in town. And he's like, oh yeah, they'll drink it. They believe it can cure many things in you know, including impotence. Yeah. And, you know, once you pass 60, you'd be amazed what you'd pay to deal with that. It's kind of like, wow, okay, we just keep going back to this.
And that scene ends with him drinking the rum.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is so gross.
Ugh. Ugh. God, it's got to taste horrible.
Ugh. And as I said, as we were watching it, there's a very finite amount. Like, you can't really replenish that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because, I mean, I guess unless you just keep topping it off.
I guess that's how you do it. Blech.
Blech. Any fetus-based rum makers out there, please let us know.
Oh, please tell me that your fetus-based rum company is called Fetal Alcohol Syndrome.
Ooh, that's good. That's really good.
Are you stewing on like what the logo would be and like
I was thinking of inappropriate jokes.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail us.
But yeah, all of the adults seem to have multiple layers to them.
Yeah,
except Conchita.
Poor Conchita,
who really doesn't have any character to speak of.
Yeah,
and
other
is,
than like sweet and pretty.
Yeah, it's. I think she serves her purpose,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not convinced that she's necessary.
Yeah.
Because, like, the main thing that she's there for is really to be killed.
Yeah.
Because there's really nothing going on character-wise with her and Jacinto. Like, mm-hmm. once she finds out what's going on, she never, like, does anything about it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she's kind of his beard.
Yeah.
In a way. Yeah. Do you know, like, I don't mean that in the actual way that term's used. I more mean, like, she gives him some semblance of, like, oh, well, you know, if she's in love with him and they're going to get and they're engaged, maybe he's not that bad.
That's true. Yeah. Because, see, the way they're introduced mm-hmm. makes Jacinto seem more, he's just like, oh, yes, the two young lovers or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, maybe he's tough on the boys, but that doesn't necessarily make him evil.
Yeah. I think what's missing for her, mm-hmm. because I think you could say that what she's ultimately doing is, she's hooking her wagon to Jacinto,
mm-hmm.
hoping that he's going to get her out of there.
Yes.
And I wish there was a scene where she kind of acknowledged that.
Yeah.
Because her being someone who is privy to what her fiancé is doing, but mm-hmm. consciously looking the other way.
Right, right. Like willfully ignorant in letting him kind of pursue this plan. Because as much as she doesn't like it, she acknowledges it's the only way they're going to get out of it.
Yeah, or even the stuff with Carmen, you know, like she knows what's going on. And
yeah, that would have been interesting if she was like, look, I don't care. Like,
yeah, and maybe they don't, I don't know, maybe she doesn't necessarily really love him, but,
right,
you know, he's the only person who's under
eligible
the age of
16, bachelor, yeah. And he promised he's going to help get her out of there, yeah.
Because I was thinking, I don't really know how necessary she is, because I think you could probably do most of the stuff she's there for with Carmen. So, because the other notable thing she's there for is to be kind of like this, the crush for Jaime.
Yes.
And I think you could probably get away with doing that with Carmen.
Mm.
It's a little different because she is the headmistress and stuff.
And I think it tips too far into like, if she started this relationship with Jacinto when he was inappropriately young, does she then just become a bad guy fully of like, oh, you're grooming and abusing all these boys?
But that's interesting though. Like, because that does put him on the same path as Jacinto in a way that they're kind of mirroring already.
True.
You know?
But I do think like we are looking back at this 25-year-old movie.
Yeah.
And I think I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that he had been working on the script for this
long time since he was in college. Yeah.
So an older woman having sex with a 17-year-old
was awesome at the time.
I wouldn't say that
for him. It was,
but culturally it was not frowned upon quite so much as we would now.
Sure.
Like we, as in our modern purview, look back on that and say that's abusive,
right?
That's damaging to that young man, that's very bad, don't do that. The same way we would if the genders were flipped, right?
Yep.
But back then, it was probably not looked at as quite so unequivocally bad.
Yeah.
And more of just like, well, you know, yeah, it's inappropriate, but
yeah.
What are you going to do?
Not to get into a whole thing, because neither of us, I think, are qualified to talk about it. But
whatever it is, I am absolutely not qualified to talk about it.
The Middle East.
I'm qualified to talk about, like, maybe one thing. And it's not even what this podcast is about.
It's the Babadook.
Yeah.
We'll get there eventually.
Probably not even that.
But, like, even, I think, culturally at the time, a 17-year-old boy sleeping with an older woman, much less taboo than vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what half the sex comedies are about.
Right, right. And so I brought it up because I do think, like, it makes her sound like more of a bad guy to somebody coming to this movie for the first time now.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas dropping that little factoid in there 25 years ago would have made you go like, oh yeah, that's,
but even so,
that's bad.
Even
but.
If I think, thankfully, even if that is the case, they present their relationship as gross enough
that
it's not like Jacinto is like, ever since I saw you when I was 17, I knew.
Right, right, right.
He's like, you've been making me do this for 15 years or whatever.
Yeah, but he also like wants to do it.
Well, I think he's only doing it so he can get the keys.
I think that
he's really bad at keys if that's what he's doing.
But he goes and he steals
a long time.
He steals a new key from her and he's not like, all right, good night, bye. He goes back to her and they have sex again.
That's true.
Like, you know what I mean? There is like a weird psychosexual thing happening between them where it's like,
none of that's cut and dry.
Yeah. And I all of this is just also like, Carmen is not presented as a villain in this.
Right.
She's a flawed character.
Yes.
She's made mistakes, but she's not another antagonist. And I think a different version of this movie, like a modern version of this movie, or one where she was also the crush object for Jaime.
Yeah.
Might make her into a villain.
Yeah, they'd probably play her about as subtly as they played Jacinto in this movie.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think it is really interesting the way that they play her, because it does make her a much more layered character.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we're not supposed to hate her.
Right,
like her death is very sad. Like you see the doctor and he's reciting poetry to her and trying to hold her as she dies, and like, he's clearly devastated, and you're supposed to feel all the pathos of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, when I saw that what Jacinto was doing was, taking a new key, my first thought was, this is a horrible plan.
Yeah.
How you keep track of which key
right,
you
they
took.
All look the same.
You put it back in the thing, but right. I mean, like, depending on where that thing is put down.
Right.
There's no way in hell you would know if you took the same
absolutely
key.
Absolutely not. There's so many plain metal keys on
Which
that
I guess
ring.
Is why he's been doing it for 10 years or however long it's taken. Does the bomb drop the same night that Santi gets killed?
Yes.
Well, that's not very subtle.
No. Like I said, it's a metaphor.
Yes.
It's a very on-the-nose metaphor.
Do you like the when everything falls apart and Jacinto blows everything up? Like is, I don't know if that's the right word, but I think that sequence is really good because I do think it's presented not realistically, but like the collateral damage is realistic in that like this is going to fuck people up.
Yep.
And not everybody's walking out of this, and especially not Carmen.
Right,
for
right.
For two reasons.
And they don't do it where it's like, oh, just one of the adults gets killed.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, of course a bunch of the kids stop and gawk.
Yeah. Especially
they're a bunch of little kids.
Especially when the car blows up. Because like the modern movie, that car blows up. And then when the doctor comes to, all the kids are like covered in soot, but they're fine.
Right.
But
in
this one, he wakes up and like half of them have been cut in half.
Right, right. Yeah. There's like one kid's torso is there and his legs are over there.
He gets just bisected by a bumper.
A bunch of them have been burned to death inside the kitchen.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. No, I mean, I think it definitely ramps the movie up.
Yeah, I think that whole sequence is really good.
Yeah.
It's the violence is effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like it doesn't feel phony.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the amping up the desperate. I also really like that. I can see Del Toro's love of comic books all over this movie. I think it's very, the graphicness of the lighting is very comic booky, the colors, and also how graphic is his use of shadows are and stuff.
Yeah.
But also, this does kind of feel like a very highbrow episode of Tales from the Crypt to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The part that really made me feel that way is, and you know, they don't do it like the, they don't really make it a huge sticking point that they you would in like an EC comic story or something, but the fact that Jacinto finds the gold, but is stranded there.
Yeah.
And so he's got the grail, but he's also fallen into the hole.
Right.
You know, like it's the thing he's after is also what brings him to his death.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like a very, in a movie that has a bit of a Catholic imagery, it's definitely
just a bit.
Yeah. Definitely a Judas, a you know, Judas hanging in the tree with his pieces of silver around his feet.
Right.
Moment. Yeah.
Right. Also, when Del Toro originally wrote this, it wasn't going to be a... Hold on, I just got to read this because I want to make sure I get this right.
Hey, oh, okay, good. That's always a good sign.
He wrote the first draft before he wrote Kronos, which is his debut movie. This, quote, very different version was set in the Mexican Revolution and focused not on a child's ghost, but a, quote, Christ with three arms.
Oh,
according to Del Toro, and as drawn in his notebooks, there were many iterations of the story, some of which included antagonists who were a doddering old man with a needle, a desiccated ghost with black eyes as a caretaker instead of the living Jacinto who terrorizes the orphans, and beings who are red from head to foot.
Huh.
That one's actually interesting because that's essentially what the ghost from Crimson Peak looks like. It's just a big red ghost.
Crimson ghost.
Crimson ghost, yeah.
Yes.
Why did I bring that up?
Because I talked about Judas.
Judas.
Yes.
Have I already talked about my favorite use of the character of Judas in popular fiction?
I don't think so.
I should say next to Jesus Christ Superstar.
Okay.
The movie Dracula 2000, which is a very forgettable...
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that one.
Post-Matrix Dracula movie, which I went to see it in the theater, had a great time.
Yeah.
And one of the key, it was Gerard Butler's first movie. He plays Dracula.
Okay, I can see that. I can see that.
And the thing that really got me with it was, you know how I love big swings.
Yes.
I give a lot of leeway to ideas that are fun.
Yes.
In this movie, they posit that all of the Catholic imagery and like crosses and silver working on Dracula is because Dracula is actually Judas Iscariot. Who, after he betrays Jesus, when he hangs himself, God doesn't let him die.
Oh.
So the rope snaps and he is now an immortal vampire.
That's kind of great.
It's fucking awesome.
I kind of want to see this movie now.
It's great.
I'm sure the movie's garbage, but I kind of want to see it.
It is, but it isn't.
Yeah.
Like it's got Christopher Plummer playing Van Helsing.
What?
Johnny Lee Miller is the lead. Who else is in it? Jerry Ryan is in it. It's dumb, but it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. Maybe we should have like a series of
dumbass movies that we love.
Yeah, that would be fun.
I do want to talk about Santi.
Yes.
The ghost. How do you feel about his look?
I think it's very cool.
Yeah.
I think it is, it works really well because it's right on that line of effective CGI stuff. Because I generally think CGI ghosts are not scary.
Yeah.
But they've got such a cool semi-translucent thing going on with him. And I love the blood coming out of the head. That's
Say I think visually he really benefits from the fact that in most of the shots around him there is this sense that there is like dirty water kind of still moving around him, like when you see him even just like walking on a hallway or whatever, he still sort of has the little like floaters and things and like the blood kind of drifting up from away from his head.
I think he uses that blood thing in Crimson Peak.
Yeah.
As well.
It's very effective.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that works better for me than when he gets too translucent and it looks a little bit like a kid in a skeleton costume. I still think it's for I'm guessing this was not a super high budget movie.
I can't imagine.
And given that it also came out in like 2001,
yeah.
I think you put those things together, it's like, yep, looks great. And I think him in the water, like when they throw Jacinto in,
yeah,
and he comes up, I think that's genuinely scary.
Yeah, and I also like that the opening credits
mm-hmm.
are over that water.
Yes.
And you don't know what you're looking at
yep.
until much later. You're like, oh, shit.
Yep.
That's either Santi or
yeah.
a very delicious baby.
I also like the little detail. I just remembered this, that Jaime can't swim.
Yes. Yeah.
And so when Santi gets thrown in, he can't even try to rescue him because he can't swim.
Right, right.
So I like that detail.
Yeah. Are you surprised that Carlos doesn't find Santi's body? I guess we don't know how deep that is.
I don't want to say I'm surprised he doesn't. I'm glad he doesn't.
Yeah.
Because I think in this era of movies, that had been done. At least a couple times. Mm-hmm. I know in The Ring.
Sure.
She goes down into the well and then finds the remains and it becomes a whole thing. And I feel like there's at least a couple others where there is like sort of a, you must go and retrieve the remains of the ghost to help put it to rest.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they don't do that with this because I don't think that would be a kid's first instinct.
Yeah.
You know?
And that goes to what I was saying before, where it's like, I like that there's, it's not like magical absolving
yes.
of the spirit.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. There's never an adult who comes in and is like, all right, you want to put this ghost boy to rest? Here's what you do. You got to do this. You got to help him get revenge. And then you got to go find his bones in the bottom of the cistern. Like, I'm very glad they did not do that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I do like how they kill Jacinto like he's a mammoth.
Yeah, a spear through the armpit.
Whoa.
Oof!
Oh, and the one through his arm, like through his like forearm near his wrist when he's reaching for the gun. But I love that like they have the mammoth lesson.
That's true.
In
That's
class,
I didn't even put that together.
And they're like, yes, like back in these times, like men used to work together to bring down the much larger prey.
That's funny.
Because they could, and then later on, they're all like sharpening their little spears and like. We're gonna kill him.
Yeah, did not even put that together.
I love it.
That's
great.
That's really good foreshadowing.
Yeah.
When I was in high school,
how many spears did you make?
No, this is totally off topic. As we finish up,
okay.
I thought I knew everything, and my teacher was telling. We were going through the story, and there's a part where it talks about one of the characters' hair. Being gray like charred cinders, right?
Okay.
And my teacher said that was foreshadowing to the fact that the boat that they were on catches fire. And I said, that's not foreshadowing. Am I right? Can you absolve my ghost here? My unfinished business.
Was the actual language that their hair was like cinders?
There was one character who had like gray hair,
uh-huh.
and in the story, it was described as his hair was gray like cinders, like ash.
Yeah.
And then later on, the boat they're on catches on fire.
And does he burn to death?
I don't think so. I don't know.
I mean, it's hard to come down on a clean ruling on this without knowing.
I'm going to say more. You're ruling in my favor. Moving on.
I would actually say I am not.
I don't know why I think about that a lot.
I think it really depends on like what quality of writing are we talking here? Are they just throwing adjectives around willy-nilly or was this a very carefully placed description?
I don't remember. It was a long time ago. Yeah. Why are you asking me these questions?
Why are you bringing it up?
I don't know. Anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Because I think this is a really great movie, especially coming off Mimic, which I think was a much higher budget, much higher profile.
Yeah.
Didn't go the way. I've actually never seen Mimic.
I haven't either.
I feel like I should at some point. Yeah. But Del Toro is he's really interesting because
I appreciate his like sensibilities and his style in a lot of things. Yeah. And I think he has a point of view.
Yes.
Which I very much like.
Yeah.
I don't think everything he does is always successful.
Yeah.
In terms of like, was this a satisfying, you know, narrative and everything, but I generally have like a positive view towards his work.
Yeah, I'm always gonna see it because I'm glad he's doing what he does.
Yes.
The fact that he could win an Academy Award for a movie about the creature, a sexy version of Creature from the Black Lagoon, is pretty impressive.
Some people would argue that the original was the sexy version.
That's true. That is true.
Based on the reactions to some of your Halloween decorations in this house.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about it. Should have invited him to my wedding.
Yeah. Should have put that mask on. Creature from the Black Lagoon mask. Ugh. You may now kiss the bride.
So yeah, I'm always going to appreciate what he's doing.
Yeah.
Not to get too nitpicky, but I think his stuff is a little too glossy for me now. One of the reasons I really like this movie is because it's dirty.
Yes.
And it doesn't have that refined look that a lot of his later stuff does. Like Frankenstein looks great, but it also looks very, what's the word? Not fake, but fake adjacent.
like too polished. Artificial. Too polished. Artificial.
It feels
very
artificial.
Yeah.
Whereas I wish it had a little bit more grit to it.
Sure.
And also he tells the same story a lot, which is woman falls in love with monster.
Yeah. Like the monster wasn't the bad guy in the end after all.
It's like, we understand you grew up as a fat kid. Aww. Like I did. Who no one liked you. No girls didn't like you. So you have to make up for it now as Frankenstein.
Is it bad that I always want to call him Gizmo now because of what we do in the shadows?
No, I think that's fine.
Gizmo.
He was on that show, right?
What?
No, I'm thinking of, he was on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh.
Yeah.
What?
He plays a really weird character.
Now I'm even
show.
More confused and I need to go find these episodes.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
All right.
but yeah, I think that's going to do it for Devil's Backbone. This is number 56 on our list. I don't know how you feel about the placement. This is a weird one where I almost don't
say it.
I don't know if I fully consider this a horror movie. Because, I mean, it does have a literal ghost in it, which is going a long way, but so does Hamlet.
Right.
Hamlet's not a horror movie. I wish it was.
Yeah.
Hamlet, I've always thought Hamlet needed a little bit more Macbeth.
I was just thinking in my head, like, that's what you have Macbeth for.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, like, it's, it feels like, I think it is in that classic sort of way.
Yes.
Where your gothic ghost story is about much more than people just running away from a ghost.
Right. I think it still counts as a horror movie.
Yeah.
I think it falls more into the line that like The Others is in or have you ever seen any of the BBC A Ghost Story for Christmas?
I've seen a couple of them,
yeah. It feels a lot to me like that, the ones that are based off of like an M.R. James story and things like that, where it's predominantly a gothic ghost story, but I still think that counts as horror.
Yeah.
Now, what number did you say it was?
56.
Would I put it at 56? Probably not.
It's pretty high.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
Pretty high. I don't know if I'd crack 100 with this one.
Yeah, I think if you told me it was 156, I'd be like,
yeah. Yeah. I wish that I could like feed our episodes into AI or something and see how many of these movies we've covered I said would not crack 100.
I was thinking that too. I was like, when we eventually, one day, hopefully far into the future, get to the point where we're like winding down this podcast, I feel like we're going to have to come up with our own list.
Oh, God.
And I'm going to regret every criticism I've ever made of this one.
This is a heavy back end.
Yeah.
Heavy back end.
For some reason, you got 7 number 156s, 0 number ones. Yeah.
excuse me. But yeah, I think I would keep it on the list.
Yeah, I think I would too.
I think I would just move it down a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. So, that's going to do it for us today. We are going to hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. And next time, hopefully my voice will have returned by then.
Uh-huh.
We'll be doing number 20,
ooh,
which is a movie called Eyes Without a Face.
Yes.
Do you know this one?
Yes.
Okay. Cause it's one of those ones where I feel like people either don't know it or they love it.
I love it.
And I've only seen it once a long time ago, and I really liked it.
Okay, cool.
So I'm very much looking forward
to
watching
this. We can stay friends.
Jeez, I'm almost out.
Yeah.
If you want to help support the show, again, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile and check us out as we're covering all of our sequels this year. It's a lot of fun. And so far, so good.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. And thank you, Amanda.
Thanks, Clay.
Thank you for supporting the show, and we will see you next time.